Good morning. Welcome to Mid Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. A state shutdown was averted and historic tax reform enacted in the special legislative session that ended over the weekend, with spending bills reaching the Secretary of State's office with just minutes to spare before the midnight deadline. Now that the dust is settling, we thought it'd be good to see what's left when the air clears. Was the tax reform worth all the partisan wrangling? Is this a victory or an indictment for tripartisan government? And how would you grade the achievements of this past session? We're going to ask you to join in this hour as we talk to Dane Smith. He's the chief political reporter for the Star Tribune. He joins us here in the studio. Good morning.
Morning, Catherine, and Happy New Year. Fiscal, that is.
Happy Fiscal New Year, indeed. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Now, let's talk about the main achievements of this session now that I figure it'll take actually a little bit longer for the dust to clear. But when we look back at this session, what's going to stand out?
Well, clearly the tax bill. A double-digit, in many cases, 20% reduction in the taxes for 2002 is certainly going to be something that people remember. It's been compared to the Minnesota Miracle of 1971. Probably is the biggest reduction in property taxes in 30 years. There are critics who contend that this is not a real reform, that it's long run it will shift the burden from business, which currently carries a disproportionate burden, and onto homeowners, and especially those with values in the lower to mid ranges. So, a 20%, what is the old saw? Reform is when my taxes go down. And heck with what happens to my neighbors, but mm-hmm. if they go down for everybody, I think most people are going to view it as reform.
And when we look at this reform, go ahead.
One other thing,
yeah.
Something that may not have been clear in a lot of the media coverage is these 20% reductions are based on what they would pay if current law was in effect right now. So it's a cut under what you would pay otherwise in 2002. It does not take into account most of the runs that were printed in the media, increases in valuation, and those valuations are increasing by 10% or more, and they probably will for many homeowners next year. So
in other words, it's softening the blow of what was coming at us. It isn't
right.
necessarily cutting what we
right.
have right now.
Dollar to dollar, it is not probably going to represent, it's not going to be that big a cut for many people.
Okay, that's good to know. It's interesting that you bring that up. Why do you think that wasn't necessarily clear in the media coverage?
Well, that's the way the numbers are presented and run by the legislative staff people who mm-hmm. do these things. And it's fair enough to reflect the cut that you would get from what would happen if there was no change in the law and no change in your valuation.
What would you rank? Would the education bills be the second most important in terms of what we're going to look at, what came out of this session?
Well, important in the sense that I think the critics of what happened, those who thought the schools should have more money, certainly see it probably as a landmark year of turning our backs on education, especially probably even more livid about this were the higher ed folks, colleges and universities, all talking about double-digit tuition increases, but to a great extent, the public school folks were very unhappy too. So, Ventura argued that they just had gotten their biggest bump ever from him in the previous budget, and that they just weren't in line this time. So to argue that this governor has, turned his back on education in terms of his entire tenure so far is probably not fair, but K-12 and higher ed were very unhappy.
How close did we actually come to a shutdown?
Pretty dang close. That was another thing that will be remembered about this session. There's never been a more thoroughgoing breakdown. No budget bills passed at the end of the session, May 21st, nothing done. Actually one bill, but Ventura vetoed that one. Ventura kept saying, the sky is falling, the end is near, and was exaggerating at times, but I believe the Secretary of State officially recorded the bills as being law about 20 minutes before the end of the fiscal year or the beginning of the next budget period, so it was about as close as it could get. you have to understand, of course, that everybody knew that it was close, and they were all kind of, they all had their eye on the clock. So maybe, you know, the wheels were in motion 3 days before.
You know, I have to say, if you're a citizen and you are not steeped in the lore of the legislature, if you're not steeped in the ways of politics here, it almost sounds like a game, and you sort of, like a movie where you know the hero's going to live through because there's a sequel coming, so hey. So I think if you're a citizen and you see that, the bills were passed, they made Secretary of State's office 19 minutes to the deadline, you think, well, yeah.
Yeah. And that's a fair enough way to view the things. Deadlines work this way for all of us in ways that I think when we reflect a little bit. I know, Catherine, did you always turn in your term papers early? Or?
Well, of course I did, Mr. Well, Smith.
And what about when you were a newspaper reporter? Did you always get those articles and columns in
well,
half a day earlier?
I was just going to say, now there's lots of editors in this town who will tell you exactly how I did it. Late, of course.
Right. And, of course, legislators themselves can rewrite the rules as they go along. I think there's some real concern here that we've we've set a new standard, that the legislative deadlines really don't mean anything anymore, the ones in the Constitution that say you have to be done by a certain time, and that the real deadline now is the beginning of the fiscal year. And I think there's a lot of people who justifiably are worried that this is going to be the way it is from now on. And especially if we have divided government, which we do with the Republican House and Democratic Senate and the Independence Party governor.
I was just going to say, so let's get to that main question of tripartisan government, as I asked earlier. Is this an indictment or a victory?
Pretty hard to see it as anything but an indictment. On the other hand, you know, the rest stops are open. It did get done, but I don't think anybody is exactly bathed in glory from this thing. The governor probably is viewed more positively than the legislature. That's typical. It sure wasn't a pretty sight.
What were the main sticking points?
Well, some of the things we've touched on, the spending on education and the relative burden of the new reduced property taxes were clearly them. But then, of course, the social issues, you know, Ventura more or less sided with the Republicans on the fiscal issues, the education and the burden, but he sided with the Democrats on the perennial issues of abortion, gay rights, and the Republicans tried to move their agenda on that score. So there were also some important issues having to do with the expansion of child care insurance to Minnesota families, the welfare cutoffs. Those are coming due, and they had to write the rules about whether people would be forgiven some of those cutoffs or would be exempted from them. So there were, in addition to the big issues, there were plenty of others that held up these conference committees for a long time. You know, there were almost comical things. At times they would be off, right towards the end they were off on $2 million. The Senate wanted to improve its technology in its chamber, get fancier computers, got to keep up with the House, you know. They had somehow forged ahead on the technology front. The House knew they had leverage there. They balked at it right up till late Friday night. And the personalities got into it, too. Mo and Swigum are both very Norwegian guys, and some people accuse them of both lacking great communication skills. And Ventura is not going to win the Nobel Peace Prize for this thing either. You know, he seemed to almost drive them further apart, and all these things figured into it.
We're talking to Dane Smith, chief political reporter for the Star Tribune. We're talking about the end, finally, of the legislative session. We'd like to know what grade you would get it. Was this tax reform worth all the partisan wrangling? Do you see this session as a victory or an indictment for tripartisan government? We'd love to hear from you. It's 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Do you think that we made some decisions too fast?
Well,
and what I mean by that is, even though the session, we went 6 weeks overtime, and yet it does seem like with a system like this, you get some pretty important decisions made at 1, 2 in the morning when people haven't had sleep.
Well, beyond the issue of of working as the House and Senate did till 3:30 a.m., which again is not unusual, nor unusual.
Mm-hmm.
These issues have really been hashed out for years and years. I can remember 15 years ago, Governor Perpich arguing that the rates need to be compressed, that our tax rates were too high on business and not high enough on homeowners. The issues of education are, it's kind of a rolling debate, year after year after year. These are not new issues or new concepts, and the philosophies, the arguments both ways have been around for a long time. To suggest that it's a brand new discussion is just not right.
I think that's an important point. And then if it is a rolling debate, perhaps is there something about tripartisan government that injects energy into that debate?
Possibly so. It's something that the voters in their wisdom have chosen, although not consciously. I mean, the fact that the Senate is controlled by Democrats and Republicans the House by Republicans is not something that people can vote on explicitly,
mm-hmm.
but that is what the voters produced, along with an independent governor. Maybe they like the idea of some balance. I did hear a lot of people say that they were surprised that your average constituents were not terribly upset about this whole thing.
Well, I think that, in fact, is one of the questions to ask this morning. When you said that they were surprised that constituents weren't that upset, well, how aware were people? How invested are they in this? As I was saying earlier, you can't help. I think that there were a lot of citizens out there who sort of looked at the wrangling going on and just saying, well, this is what it is these days, and not really that concerned.
Yeah, they're kind of sophisticated about the whole thing, I almost think. You know, they're used to it. They've seen it in Congress, the federal level. They just figured, they'll get it done, and they did.
We'd like to know if that fits your description. It's 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities at 651-227-6000. Now, you had a piece in this morning's paper, Dame Smith, on triangulation. Let's define it and tell us how it works.
Well, the first I saw that the word really was coined was the way Bill Clinton, who was elected as a new Democrat, managed to work between liberals and his own party and Republicans who eventually controlled the Congress. This term was often used derisively of him because it suggested that he didn't really stand for anything, that he was Machiavellian, and that he would move all the time, steal ideas from the opposition, everything from welfare reform to tax cuts. And yet he was generally considered a pretty effective president who's lucky to preside over a tremendous boom in the economy, but it struck me, thinking about Clinton and Ventura, that they had this in common. They are both very definitely considered centrist, mainstream people, and Ventura, in perhaps a different way than Clinton. Clinton, after all, was a Democrat. Was doing this too. It's something that we saw from his first session and his second one, but especially in his third one. Citing subtly, almost, kind of hard to use that word in any way with Ventura, but subtly with one side and then the other, working them back and forth until he finally got a deal. Now, a six-week overtime and not finishing it till 20 minutes before a government shutdown, you'd have to question whether that's skill or not.
But how about those who would argue that when you're talking about tax reform this historic, it's okay to have 6 weeks go over the deadline?
Sure, that's a fair argument. As it was pointed out several times in 71 when the last big deal came through, it took them till October.
We're going to go to Joe. He's calling us from St. Paul. Joe, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I had a comment regarding you had asked whether an indictment or
are you a
danger
nervous
to the road on my handheld cell phone here. Just a comment that I really think this shows the strength of three parties, and that by having three negotiation parties, it certainly does draw it out, but I think it's pretty standard negotiations to come right up to the deadline, and that by having three different points of view, that it really is a fairer tax law for more people, and that more of all of the party's constituencies are represented.
Thanks, Joe. I think your views are probably shared by at least a plurality of Minnesotans, if not a majority. Polls we've seen suggest that people are happy with the role Ventura plays, happy with his job performance, and as strange as the as a three-party thing is, and as complicated as it is, it seems to be pleasing most of the people most of the time.
One thing that strikes me, and you, in fact, touched on this earlier, that when you do polls, it's easier to like the governor, as you know, no matter who the governor is. It's easier to approve of a governor's performance than it is with an entire legislature. It's sort of easier to shoot down that particular institution.
Right. The legislature as an institution often looks kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And it's filled, no matter what your political views are, with a half to two-thirds of people you can't stand. Polls often show that people disapprove of the legislature as an institution, but think their own man or woman who represents them is just ducky.
We're going to go to Rachel in Minneapolis. Rachel, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I think it's distressing, actually, to see the egos getting in the way, knowing that there's so much at stake. You know, I know that our legislators are trying to work on the behalf of their so-called constituents, but the reality is they work for everybody, and allowing too much ego to get in there doesn't work for any of us, and especially in a bill that, you know, if they hadn't passed this, many people would have suffered not having the funding, and I just don't think that's responsible or acceptable when they are working for us, the people.
Egos, yes. they have them.
Can you give us an example of when ego got in the way at some point in the last 6 weeks?
Oh, like every day. I'm trying to think. Well, there was one incident. This is somewhat hearsay, but there was a point in the legislative negotiating. People reported that in a meeting at the governor's mansion, this was actually before the May 21st deadline, the governor called Speaker Swiggum a name, and it was faintly obscene, even by today's standards. And then there was a report that he told House Majority Leader Tim Pawlenty that he would bury him, which we haven't heard since Nikita Khrushchev banged his shoe on the table back in the UN in the 50s. If you understand the context there, that's kind of interesting because everybody knows Tim Pawlenty may very well run for governor. And so the bury you probably had something to do with that. Politicians are driven by ego and a desire to please as many people as possible. And when you think about it, that's good. You know, when we poll people and ask them about what they look for in a political leader, they always want a strong character. That requires a certain amount of ego, and it's kind of a conundrum. You want it, and yet it does look counterproductive and at times almost shameful the way people take things personally and think of their own image and do not get together.
You know, I know that you have been covering the legislature for a while. You certainly have, I think, a nuanced view of what goes on there. In the same way that I think citizens can sort of write off some of this wrangling and say, oh, they'll pass it. We're not really in that much of a danger from a shutdown. There's also a tendency to sort of dismiss the work that goes on in the legislature and say, they're a bunch of clowns. Everyone's just wrangling. Who cares about it? What are we missing from the last? What didn't we see from the last 6 weeks that we should be aware of? You know, we had, you know, Claudia was just saying, listen, I'm tired of these egos getting in the way of, you know, really serious work that was supposed to make an impact on lives. I'm assuming that there were some moments of somber hard work there that maybe we didn't see.
Yeah, lots of hard work for sure. If I told you, you know, what you missed, that would be sort of an admission that I'm keeping something from people.
Not that it wasn't out there, that it wasn't covered, but, you know,
I think one thing is that these people like each other a lot more than it looks like they do. A lot of times you'll see people going at each other as if they despise each other. And when it's all over, you'll see them with their arms around each other, or at least smiling. And you know, in a way, that looks like hypocrisy, but they're doing a job. They have political parties and causes to advance. And on a personal level, I don't think there's any. I think the personal animosity that appears to be there is greatly overstated.
We're going to go to Dennis calling us from St. Paul. Dennis, welcome to Mid Morning.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
I just want to comment, as a state employee, I think an awful lot of us experienced a great deal of stress about our jobs and where the next mortgage payment was coming from, and I think that was grossly unfair. I think we should all be given at least some recompense for all the stress we
compensation for pain and suffering, basically, or?
Yes. So I'm gonna take this Wednesday off.
Okay. A regular sick day or what? Well, that's not going to happen. I understand the fear out there about perhaps being out of work for a while, but I think most people who really understood the situation knew that they would probably, state employees would be compensated for their work, and that this, even if it got done and there was a few days or a week or so of a actual shutdown, that they would not lose very much at all. There was talk of lights on bills too, bills that would, and in fact, this may be, it's one of the things that Ventura didn't address, that those bills are still hanging out there, and he may be talking today, or his administration may, about what to do with this with an eye towards the future. They were prepared to pass bills that kept government functioning at its current appropriation level, or there were lights on bills that would have actually enacted the bills that didn't pass, which raises a real interesting constitutional question. So I think the real prospect, and maybe it's the fault of the players themselves for scaring people, was not very strong, that there would be big, long, lengthy layoffs and loss of compensation.
There was also some judicial action as well. My understanding is the Attorney General's office went to Ramsey County District Court saying, look, we would like to have a Judge Lauren Cohen signed an order saying, yes, you have the... Explain how that works and what happens with that now.
Well, it's moot now, of course, but there was a lot of confusion about that. There was... The Ventura administration was viewing that court order very narrowly, and there was some talk that they wanted to really make the legislature feel the pain of their failure to come to an agreement, and that they would have, in fact, at least for a few days, sent some people home. The Hatch and the others, Attorney General Hatch and the others who won that that order, said they thought that it applied to essentially all state government, and it would have kept operating.
We're talking to Dane Smith. He's the chief political reporter for the Star Tribune. Now that the dust is settling, the bills have been signed, a historic special session has ended, and we have, again, so-called historic tax reforms being compared to the Minnesota Miracle of 1971. We'd like to get your take on the legislative session this year. Was that tax reform worth all the partisan wrangling? Is this a victory or an indictment for tripartisan government? There are those who are saying that this past session shows that Governor Ventura has proven himself a master at triangulation. Others don't feel as strongly. We also want to know if you thought that observers from outside the political process were invested at all in this. If you're a citizen, did you pay any attention to this? Did you think there was going to be a government shutdown? Did you care? 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. What does this mean for the future sessions? Do you think we're going to be looking at deadlines being pushed further and further, closer to the end of a fiscal year? It's 651-227-6000. Of course, we're also interested in what you think about the way we ended up divvying up education funding. Other issues of concern to you, it's 651-227-6000. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're going to turn now to Greta Cunningham. She's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.
Thank you, Catherine, and good morning. Vice President Cheney is keeping up his usual schedule today. He returned to work this morning with his new heart pacemaker. He's meeting with President Bush this morning. Then he'll take energy policy questions from radio reporters. His spokeswoman calls it a typical day. Cheney is not planning any public appearances today. A dual-purpose pacemaker was implanted in Cheney's chest in an hour-long procedure at a Washington hospital this weekend. He was home a few hours later. United Airlines reportedly wants out of a deal to purchase U.S. Airways. Published reports say the airline has told U.S. Airways management it wants to discuss terminating their agreement. United officials reportedly don't think the regulators will approve the merger. Power is still being restored to customers in several eastern states battered by severe thunderstorms yesterday. Tens of thousands of people from Maine to Virginia lost power. Now that the storms are gone, much cooler, drier weather has moved into the region. Representatives of movies and television actors and producers are scheduled to resume talks this afternoon. A marathon 14-hour session that went into the early hours of the morning ended without reaching a deal. Both sides say they're still hoping to avoid a strike. In regional news, state employees returned to work this morning as usual. There was no government shutdown yesterday because lawmakers finished their work this weekend before the deadline for a government shutdown. Governor Ventura signed major tax and spending bills, including a $1.5 billion in tax relief and an overhaul of the property tax system. 3M has lowered its second quarter earnings forecast. The maker of Scotch tape and Post-it notes cites continued weakness in the U.S. economy and an economic slowdown in Europe and the Asia-Pacific region. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for scattered showers and thunderstorms statewide. They will spread from west to east today. High temperatures ranging from 68 in the northeast to near 78 in the far west. Right now in Thief River Falls, it's cloudy and 54. Duluth reports partial sunshine and 55. It's cloudy in Alexandria and 53. Partly sunny in Rochester and 57. And in the Twin Cities, some scattered light rain showers with a temperature of 58 degrees. That's a look at the latest news.
Today's programming is supported by the Advocates of Minnesota Public Radio. Contributors include the Sharon and Bruce Hendry Family Foundation, Advocates for the Environment, and Improving K-12 Education.
Members are our single most important source of income. Thank you for your continued support.
Minnesota Public Radio listeners are invited to spend an evening with NPR senior news analyst Daniel Schorr Thursday night, July 12th at 7 at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul. Tickets are free for NPR members and $5 for non-members. They're available at the Bibelot Shops located in St. Paul at St. Anthony Park and Grand Avenue and in Minneapolis in Linden Hills. Tickets are also available at the Fitzgerald box office or by calling Ticketmaster 612-673-0404.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. A reminder that we're going to continue our political morning by talking with Senator Paul Wellstone. He'll be in the studio to talk about his latest book, The Conscience of a Liberal, Reclaiming the Compassionate Agenda. We'll talk to him about what it really means in this early part of the 21st century to be a liberal and a Democrat. Make sure you stick around for that conversation. Meanwhile, we are continuing our conversation with Dane Smith, chief political reporter for the Star Tribune. We're talking about the end of the special legislative session. We'd like to take your calls and insights. 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. We're going to go to John in Roseville. John, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. I just have a comment to make. I'll take it the answer off the air. I'm new to Minnesota. I came in as what I've learned is called a liberal Democrat. I never knew the word before. I call it just being fair and just to people. I saw a governor elected who actually did not have any sort of a majority, but he has claimed to have had a majority since the election. And I see that he was elected by college students and others who have now turned against them. And I see a state where there's an enormous surplus, which is actually less than it's thought to be. And yet there are roads going down. There is a bus system in just chaos. There are airplanes zooming over people's heads and no one's doing anything about the noise. And I think it's a failure. I think the whole session was a failure. And I'm very, very happy that at least the Democrats, led by Roger Moore, stood up as long as they could for what they believed.
Okay.
That's all. Thank you.
You make some valid points, John. I don't think I've ever seen a session where it was so clear that one group lost and even viewed themselves as losers, even even when these deals are closed and people feel that they got the short end of the business, they often will show up and celebrate the ending of the session and try to put a good spin on the best parts of it for them. But in this case, Senate Majority Leader Moe, as well as Taxes Committee Chairman Larry Pogamiller and Finance Committee Chairman Doug Johnson, all voted against the tax bill. Really unusual.
Well, I thought at one point they said they were for it lock, stock, and barrel. What happened?
Well, they were, as Moe's defense was that what he was for, the lock, stock, and barrel support referred to ending the session, getting the agreement on the floor out of the conference committee so that it could be voted upon. And many suburban DFLers did vote for it. It wouldn't have passed, obviously, if the caucus as a whole was opposed to it. A strong majority of Democrats voted for it. But there was a core of leaders, northeastern Minnesotans, and mostly urban liberals, who voted no. And that was interesting. They clearly felt like losers. There was talk all through the session, and on the final day, Senator Moe talked about what he felt was a spirit of meanness, especially towards the urban core. They felt they lost out on the property tax end, on the shift in the burden. The school formulas were adjusted to reduce some of the advantage that the inner cities have had because of their high concentrations of minority and impoverished students. The welfare debate also turned kind of ugly at times against urban citizens, and so John's views about this being an unhappy result are certainly shared by a lot of people.
What impact do you think this will have on the Democratic Party here?
Well, that's a good question. I'm wondering whether tactically it might not have made more sense, given that the whole shift in power is continuing towards the suburbs, and the Democrats have actually been pretty competitive there. It might not have made sense for the Democrats to swallow their pride or just suppress their unhappiness in some areas and say this is a great victory for people with middle-valued homes. What's interesting about this is that the value of homes outstate Minnesota, especially Northeast, is far less than it is in the metro area. And a lot of people who would not consider themselves affluent or very wealthy have high-valued homes. 150 to 200,000 is very typical in the Twin Cities, and in the suburbs, that's pretty standard for two parents working at fairly mid-level jobs. So how that plays out, we don't know yet. But it seems to me that the Democratic base, which has been in the cities and in the Iron Range, was unhappy, and yet they have to compete in those suburbs, and this legislation probably actually helped them.
We're going to go to Greg. He's calling us from Bemidji. Greg, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
As far as the session goes, I kind of think that it's an indictment of the public. It felt like the public just waited around for something to be done to them rather than getting involved in the process. And also, from my perspective, I kept on hearing from Representative Stigum that the decrease in rental property rates was going to benefit renters. In fact, he always referred that renters were getting a tax decrease. And I was just wondering, is there something that allows renters to get that money, or is he just trying to pull the wool over renters' eyes, thinking that the Republicans are doing something for them? And also, there was a little bill amendment that I didn't see in the Star Tribune at all, and it had to do with renters getting charged for water rates without any kind of monitoring as far as how much they use. And I understand that was a bill that was passed this year too, but I never see anything about it in the Star Tribune. So it seems like the public's confused by all the information or lack of information. I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Well, Greg, I'm confused too, frankly. You wouldn't believe the state of confusion when all this is going on, and I'll have to check into that bill on the water rates. It escaped my notice. I don't have responsibility for covering all of the major issues, but your point about renters is a good one. The critics of the tax bill suggested that renters never get the benefit from cuts in property taxes on the people who actually, the landlords, the people who own the property, that the market forces are such that the demand for rental property is so great that they will just swallow the take the tax cuts, maybe invest them in improving the property, but maybe just keep them, and that you won't see any reductions in rents. But it's bound to have the effect of at least preventing the kinds of increases that we've seen in the past. And the real argument behind cutting the apartment owners' rates so much is that it would act as an incentive to create more of this housing, which is, and there were actually some specific provisions that really cut the rates on brand new rental property. So that policy is aimed at actually changing the market so that there's more rental property and that the cost of it declines a little bit. I think the arguments that it will do that are fair enough.
We're going to go to Patty calling us from Lino Lakes. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm thinking back to January and wondering how they go about prioritizing what they work on, because at the time I was just astounded. It seemed to me like they spent a lot of time discussing Governor Ventura's Saturday night goings-on. And it seemed frivolous to me.
Yes, this Patty, this is one of the things that the governor kept saying, that for 5 months they worked on bills to ban Coke machines in schools and to ban tattoos or to make it harder for kids to get tattoos, and it didn't seem like they were paying any attention at all to the big issues. That argument's a little unfair. They were working in committee on these major bills. They were beginning to introduce them and work through the numbers. Maybe part of this is the media's fault. You know, some of these issues that aren't so ponderous and complicated, we like to glom onto and publicize because they're interesting stories. And that sometimes gets a little more play than a daily story on every aspect of tax and budget.
One thing that also strikes me is it's almost easier also to either provoke a discussion like this,
right,
or to write an analysis piece on the leadership qualities of
a
Ventura.
And personalities.
Exactly.
Right. Yep. I plead guilty.
We're going to go. Yeah, I guess I better too. We're going to go to Sue in Long Prairie. Sue, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I've been studying the governor's language and the way he communicates for my master's thesis, so I've paid a lot of attention to what's going on.
Master's thesis in?
In English.
Okay.
And I'm looking at his style and his audience. And I think Governor Ventura believes he speaks to and for the average citizen who feel they don't have a voice in the process. And I'm wondering if you think that the legislatures have that in mind and maybe pay attention to that during negotiations. Do you think that's a factor that he really believes he speaks for the average citizen?
Could you be just a little bit more specific when you ask why whether you think they're conscious of it, or are you asking whether they try to neutralize it or play the same game with the same kind of language, or?
No, I don't. I just wonder if they have in mind, well, Governor Ventura is, he really does speak for the average citizen, and so maybe we need to pay attention to that, because they might get upset if we go against their wishes or against his wishes, or... I just think he mm-hmm. Speaks for, mm-hmm. or thinks he believes he speaks for the average citizen, and whether or not they get involved, he still speaks for them and support him. And I wonder if they have in mind the support that maybe he does really have out in the public.
Well, short answer is yes. I think legislative leaders and all of Ventura's adversaries in the Democratic and Republican Party are keenly aware of his clout, of his ability to command the bully pulpit, of his approval ratings, which have been between 60% and 70%, and as healthy as any Democrat or Republican governor in the past. And they're both respectful of it, I think kind of fearful and responsive to it, too. That's why, when he came out with the big property tax reduction, there were a number of ways they could have gone. They could have cut income taxes or sales taxes, or they could have spent all the money on roads and schools. But that's why he won. That property tax thing stuck. He did not get everything he wanted. He also wanted an income tax cut, and he wanted to expand the sales tax to services. He didn't get all of it, but he's definitely a respected player, and in the end, he won.
Let's talk about redistricting. Both parties had proposals. We have elections coming up next year, and maybe we should also explain what redistricting is.
Oh, man.
Well, the short version.
Right,
we're talking about redrawing the boundaries.
Right. Every 10 years, the census comes out, and people move around, and population grows some places and not others, and you have to have, by law, districts that are the same, have the same number of people in them, equal representation, one man, one vote, one woman, one vote. That has to be done. There were some big shifts in Minnesota, as there was in the rest of the country, big suburban growth. The cities grew, but not as fast as the suburbs, so they're going to lose members. Suburbs are going to get more. Rural Minnesota is going to get fewer, and that has to be done. Democrats and Republicans absolutely could not agree on it. The Republicans came up with a plan, for instance, that collapses Minneapolis and St. Paul into one congressional district for the first time in more than 100 years. Democrats couldn't abide that. It's probably going to the courts. There may be some hearings in the next few months, but almost everybody knows that this is going to go in the courts.
We're going to go to Michelle in St. Paul. Michelle, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay.
Good. My question is, what has happened to the moderate Republican voice? It seems like over the last couple of years, the conservative agenda has pushed to the forefront. Where is the moderate Republicans, and were they able in years past to build a coalition with the Democrats that they were unable to build this year? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, in a big political star way, you'd have to say that with Governor Carlson gone, that there isn't really and we have Congressman Jim Ramstad, who is one of three Republican congressmen, is certainly a moderate. And there are a number in the legislature, key people too, Taxes Committee Chairman in the House, Ron Abrams, and there's a number of others who are influential people, and they are not, their demise has been greatly exaggerated. They are there, and they are effective part of the Republican coalition. However, they have lost a couple. And it's kind of demoralizing, I think, for moderate Republicans to have seen Dean Johnson switch parties and Judy Dutcher switch parties, which they did last year. And, in fact, Dutcher's one of the more prominent candidates for governor, but as a Democrat. And so the basic notion that the moderate Republicans are losing ground in their own party and continue to at least have that presence eroded is pretty fair argument.
Yeah, after the last session, House Speaker Steve Swiggin wasn't sitting so well with his own party leadership.
Right.
In fact, they even put some governors, if you will, on his behavior. He had to get things passed by a caucus before he could do things. How do you think he's doing this time?
Well, I think he's pretty happy. He's a nice guy. He's maybe too nice for his own good is the basic critique of him within his own party. Last year, one of the party's big contributors sent around a letter saying Swiggin must go, that he was too soft a negotiator, that Mo had gotten the better of him. And that dynamic really pervaded this session, too. There was sort of a feeling that Swiggin would not be had again. And he had this board of people that Mo and Ventura kept complaining about, that Swigum couldn't make his deals on his own, that he had to go to this this group, and they were
derided. I heard the nickname of that group by its opponents was the Taliban.
The Taliban. There were a lot of nicknames applied to it. It was sort of his Committee of Public Safety, or lots of derisive terms for it. But Swigum, I think, handled it rather adroitly. He, it was clear that they were in place, and it was almost like he liked having them there, because it was a way for him to stiffen his resolve, and it was a factor in this thing going 6 weeks overtime. He wouldn't back down. And of course, Mo is a famously tough negotiator, but Swigum's strength, call it stubbornness, was kind of a new factor. This little committee that he had to clear things with was a factor, and probably one of four or five things that most accounted for this lengthy session.
We're going to go to Gary in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I was just wondering if your guest could comment on some of the costs that this lengthy session incurred that don't seem to be talked about. I'm a state employee, and I know that from our agency there was a whole lot of contingency planning and who might work, who might not work, how to cover things, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of discussion of the fact that all this time was taking away from people's time that they might be doing other work, and especially when I hear discussions of, well, maybe now the new deadlines in future legislative sessions are not going to be the deadlines, but, you know, the end of the fiscal year. I'd like to know what you think about that, and I'll hang up and take your comments off the air here.
Well, Gary, the governor did mention this quite frequently, actually, but it's hard to quantify. He kept saying, you know, my people are not able to provide the services that they're required by law to provide because they're preoccupied with planning for a shutdown. I think at the higher levels that was probably true. I did not hear much about, you know, driver's licenses not being sent out or parks not being cleaned because of the contingency planning. There is a quantifiable cost, or at least roughly quantifiable, to the special session per day. They were saying that it was anywhere from 20 to 25,000. You figure 30 days, not counting some weekend off, for per diem mostly, we're talking over $500,000 maybe in extra cost just from legislators having to be there. But $28 billion budget, maybe not that big a deal.
We're going to go to Chris in White Bear Lake. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you.
Hi.
I was going to comment on the fact that I feel that the voters are so apathetic about what happens during the session that I think they realize that the end of the session doesn't mean much. It's the end of the government services that's really important, and that the politicians can say what they want, do what they want, the media can comment on it, but nobody's really going to get upset and realize there isn't going to be a backlash until the end of services.
Well, Chris, I think that's, again, a view that hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans share. You always hear problems about apathy. Perspective there, if we're apathetic, we're at least less apathetic than most other states. Our voters, I'm always surprised when I do poll stories and call people up at random at how well-informed they are and how well-developed their opinions are. And year after year, we have highest voting turnout in the country. And by most other measures of civic health, Minnesota's, bad as it may seem, better than others.
We're going to go to Judy in Minnetonka. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. My comment is that I think it was real short-sighted of our legislature to cut taxes and not fund education fully. I think in a state like Minnesota, where we don't have weather working on our side, in a mobile society as we are in 2001, our best and brightest aren't going to stay. Their kids graduate high school, they go off to college, We don't make a community for them to come back to when we don't have good higher education. And I think that's going to affect our industry and our corporations. They won't have the people here to hire because we're not drawing them. And so I think it was very short-sighted.
Yes, well, you're obviously among many who see a real and palpable trend here in Minnesota. Our government, as a share of our income, is getting smaller. There's a index called the price of government, and for years we were up around counting taxes, fees, everything that the government spends. It was at about, 18% of income, and now it's down a full percentage point or two. That's a lot of money. It's not a radical change. I think we're still probably one of the top 10 states in taxes and government, but there is also a feeling that Minnesotans got what they paid for, and now we're changing our essential character a little bit.
Let's go to Greg in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'm just wondering, I read in the Star Tribune this morning that four fingers are pointing to the legislature to blame for every one that's pointing at the governor. And I'm wondering how this can be, because as far as I know, the governor is the only one that's on a full-time salary that's involved in this process, whereas the legislature is all being paid part-time. A lot of them are coming from around the state and having to stay in the cities and really dedicate their time, whereas the governor is really the only one I see putting a part-time effort into this thing. How is the governor able to put on this image?
Well, I think you're probably referring to a reference I had in the story about a pollster who says that he thought that by a 4-to-1 margin, most people thought blamed the legislature more than the governor for this problem, this lengthy 6-week special session. This always happens. The governor, for one thing, it's not the governor's direct responsibility to pass laws. By culture and tradition, everybody knows that governors are supposed to propose budgets and supposed to be involved in it, but it is not their direct responsibility, and he made that point over and over again, so that accounts for a lot of it. It's probably fair to suggest that the governor, and we talked about this earlier, is not a great peacemaker. By personality, constitution, his essential makeup is not that of a person who warmly works with people and brings them together. And so that criticism of him as having essentially failed or almost failed is certainly out there too. But there's no question, I think, that most people don't blame him for it.
Okay, we've run out of time, Dane Smith. Just when does the next session start?
Oh, my God. I think sometime in February.
All right.
Even yours is a shorter one, but...